This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota. Today we'll begin our show with Mindy Greiling. She is a former Minnesota legislator, and she's the author of a brand new book that's coming out from the University of Minnesota Press, Fix What You Can, Schizophrenia and a Lawmaker's Fight for Her Son. Mindy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug, for having me.
Why did you write the book?
Well, I wrote the book for a variety of reasons, but I would say the overarching reason was so that people could have empathy for people like my son, Jim, who has schizoaffective disorder, a type of schizophrenia, and for families like mine, because so many people, I think, don't quite realize how horrible that illness can be. And because it's so little talked about, I think it gets lumped into lots of other mental illnesses, many of which are also very serious, but I think schizophrenia kind of stands alone. So that was my main reason, but I had some subplots in the book and in my methods of madness for writing the book. And one of them was also that families and people with mental illness, if they're able, need to advocate and scratch and claw at the mental health system to even be able to get services.
Why the title, Fix What You Can?
Well, because you can't fix everything, I guess. I tried because I was a assertive mother and educated myself as quickly as I could and did everything I could. And then, like you said, I had the added huge benefit of being at the table as a state legislator in Minnesota. So I could not only try to fix the mental health system for my son, I could go to the legislature and write bills and work on my colleagues and try to build consensus to change the mental health system and to get more funding. But I quickly found out, and I still have to resign myself to the fact that you fix what you can. There's no way anyone can fix everything all at one time. And, we need to strive for that, but it's a pretty big lift.
You mentioned that your son has a schizoaffective disorder. How does that manifest itself? Describe for our listeners what this means.
Well, it's actually both schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So the hallmark for schizophrenia is delusions and hallucinations, hearing voices, seeing things that aren't there, thinking that you can control other people's thoughts or that they can read your thoughts or their whatever they said that they didn't mean much by, you can discover secret meaning just for you. And then bipolar disorder, the hallmark of that is mood swings. You know, you could have extreme mania where you think you could practically fly and you're all powerful and you can get everything done, or you're in the depth of depression. And there could be a long time between those two states, or it could be rapid cycling where you go in pretty quick order from one to the other. And when you have schizoaffective, you have both.
When did you discover that your son was dealing with this difficulty?
Well, he was, in retrospect, of course, every family and every person can see that you were sick before you were diagnosed. And we think he was actually becoming sick, you know, along around eighth or ninth grade. And he actually thinks from the time he was 11 years old, he noticed that something wasn't right with him. But he wasn't diagnosed until he was 21, which is often the case. And as also is often the case, he was using drugs, you know, marijuana and other street drugs. And that just accelerates the pace of your getting a mental illness and exacerbates the severity of it. And it also masks the symptoms. So we knew he was dealing with using drugs, but we didn't really know that he had a mental illness of like schizophrenia until he was actually diagnosed, which is kind of unusual because my grandmother, who I write a little bit about in the book as well, also had schizophrenia. She had actual schizophrenia and was very paranoid, but she just presented differently. She wasn't using drugs, and she got her illness later in life, as women often do. and wasn't quite as florid in her presentation. So I didn't make the connection at all until that shocking day when a psychiatrist said that Jim had schizophrenia.
And how long ago was that?
It was in 1999. He's been sick now for 20 years. And I, you know, when I was as a legislator, I just didn't have time to write about this, but I really thought there needs to be a way to educate people, you know, more about what mental illness really means if you're talking about schizophrenia and all the flaws in our mental health system. So when I retired, then I finally started writing this book. But I was in the legislature for 14 more years out of my 20 after Jim got sick.
And you represent a part of the Twin Cities that includes Roseville, I believe?
Correct. Yep, just north of St. Paul, inner ring suburbs.
Mindy Greiling is the author of Fix What You Can, Schizophrenia and a Lawmaker's Fight for Her Son. Mindy, can you give us some context here? How prevalent is this kind of mental illness?
Well, schizophrenia, there's, you know, the rule of thumb is one out of every 100 people. And so that's actually a lot of people. It's millions of people. And, you know, I think it's not generally known to be quite so prevalent because people don't talk about it. We're getting better in 2020. People are talking about, you know, clinical depression and anxiety and panic disorders. And celebrities are coming forward that have bipolar disorder and other mental illnesses. But schizophrenia is the big one that is still, by and large, not as talked about because it's so dreadful, but also, you know, you aren't as apt to get full recovery from it. And I think that, you know, keeps it in the shadows, and that's part of why I'm talking about it.
Well, that statistic is very sobering. Minnesota has a population of about 5 million people. That would be 50,000 people with schizophrenia.
Yep, one in 100.
Mm-hmm. So,
good math.
It sounds like the difficulty, the illness, is more prevalent than the capacity of the mental health care infrastructure.
Very much so. You know, often the system is designed for people with other mental illnesses besides schizophrenia. And, you know, when you get around to involuntary treatment, civil commitment, the people at the table, especially those who themselves have a mental illness, are adamant that people's rights must be respected. And in their cases, that's true, you know. But when you've got someone who doesn't recognize that they're ill and they are manifesting in very scary ways, then someone needs to step in and help them. But our mental health system is not designed to do that easily. And also, you know, a lot of the, like, time you can spend in a psych ward or crisis centers that are short-term or short-term community care, you know, they work really well for people with other illnesses. But schizophrenia is not an illness you get over. It's not episodic. You don't clean up and, you know, skate off and no one knows you have it until you have another episode. You always have schizophrenia. It's always challenging. And the mental health system is not as geared for this illness as it is for others.
And lots of people who suffer mental illness don't have a supportive family like yours apparently is, because they're on their own. And, how are they represented among the homeless population, for example, or how are they represented in prisons and jails?
Well, in the homeless population here in Minnesota, we have something called the Wilder Research Center, and every so many years, I think it's every four, they go out and do a count, you know, of how many and who are homeless. And they have, you know, startling statistics where sometimes it could be, you know, 50 to 75% of people who are homeless have some sort of mental illness. And in the prisons and jails, depending on the day and what mental illnesses you're counting, it could be 25%, it could be, you know, half. And that's, you know, all mental illnesses. But people with schizophrenia, definitely when they don't get care in the system, it doesn't work for them. People are like, well, they're not sick enough, we can't make them get any help. Then they, you know, their families wear out. And, you know, we're just a very persistent family. and we, you know, keep fighting and we're assertive. But a lot of families who are just as good as the Grylings just wear out. They don't have as many, you know, political connections or resources, and they just are, you know, can't deal with it anymore, or their person runs off and they don't even know where they are. And once they're in the prisons or jails, you know, families kind of often shut down and don't know what to do, or there isn't much to do. So I think it's, you know, at the best we could call it would be benign neglect. But I think if we really want to face it, I think it's malice aforethought. I think we should know better, that this is a different illness that needs to be treated differently than other mental illnesses. And it's unethical to turn a blind eye to people who are this sick. You know, we don't do that for older people who might have Alzheimer's. If they're running naked in the street or assaulting people or, you know, just being a nuisance with how they're talking to others, you know, we kindly help them, you know, get care and get them into memory units and so forth. And we do the same for people in crises who have schizophrenia.
Well, we were reminded this summer by the George Floyd incident in the Twin Cities that sometimes the police response ends in a tragic way. And I'm not suggesting that George Floyd was mentally ill. I don't know that. But this is commonly a response for somebody going through a mental crisis. We call 911 and the police respond. What's the good and the bad of that?
Well, the good of it is they can come really fast. You know, they can control the traffic lights. They have speedy cars, and they often more and more these days have some training. They certainly are trained to deal with violent situations, and many of them have CIT training, crisis intervention training, where they have some knowledge of mental illness. But the bad of it is, and George Floyd is a good example, I don't know either anything about his mental stability. I have read that he had been using some drugs of some sort, and that, you know, goes hand in hand. Half the people with mental illness use some sort of street drugs and vice versa. So, you know, that's just our one clue. But a quarter of the people who die and are shot by police, killed by police, have a mental illness, and half of that quarter are people of color. So families that are African American or Asian or Indigenous or Hispanic or other people of color, they have to be even more afraid than our family is to call the police, because they know the facts that, you know, it could end in tragedy. Our son has dealt with the police. We've called the police several times, and he's been in jail three times, and we interact with the criminal justice system at more times than we would care to. But I tend to think of them, unless things go really wrong and Jim, you know, would turn on them and they would think he had a weapon, I don't think, it's not the top of my mind that they're going to kill him. I think of them as, I need to call them as a last resort, and then that they'll come and help get him to the hospital. But that isn't the case with how people of color think. And it's also not exactly, knowing how people do get killed, it's not a calming thing even for me to call them. Plus, it's just scary to take that drastic step, and then you know that your family member is going to be very upset that you called the police. You know, that alone is scary, but it can end poorly. But it's just plain a necessary thing, because our mental health system is dysfunctional, and there's nothing else you can do if you're in a bad situation. We've called the crisis team. You know, when the people after George Floyd, who say, you know, defund the police or eliminate the police or any of that sort of thing, and often they say the mental health system can take care of the people with mental illness. But our family knows that if we call the crisis team and we say, our son, Jim, isn't willing, he doesn't think he needs to go to the hospital, then they will say their hands are tied. They could come out and assess him, but if he wasn't willing to go, unless he meets a very high threshold of danger to himself or others, then they would not be able to do anything. And every family that deals with mental health crises knows that their family member calms down. You know, when the police are coming, when the crisis team are coming, they can hold it together while they're there. But then when they leave, everything is worse for the family, and the person is even more upset. So it's a crapshoot to call the crisis team who's going to come and go. It's better, we have found, to wait a little longer till they're sicker and then call the police, and maybe they will do something.
I have a friend who has a son with schizophrenia, and that son occasionally lives in an apartment, is quite often with them. What's the circumstance with your son, Jim?
Well, our son, Jim, is also living in an apartment, and he has a nice apartment in Minneapolis, and after almost 2 years of trying to get something for him where he had nowhere to go for a very long time, because it's very, very difficult to get any kind of housing for people who have a criminal record, as our son does, or has a poor financial background, as our son does. So then nobody wants to rent to somebody like that. So, you know, it takes a very long time to get a place. But quite frankly, he doesn't even like it there, though. He's hardly ever there because it's a lonely place. You know, to have an apartment where there are no supportive services is a mixed blessing, because, you know, to be all alone in your apartment, it's not the magic perfect solution just to be in a lonely apartment.
Your son is in his 40s now?
He's 42, yep.
How are you and your husband planning for his future when you aren't there?
Well, that's a good question that every family faces. And we have a trust for our son so that he will be financially able to have a few extras. It's a supplemental trust, so it means that it can't be used for his basic living, but it can be used if he ever needed to take a trip or have medical care or dental care for people who are on government assistance is almost non-existent unless you want your teeth pulled or something like that. So we have, you know, he will get half of our estate, and his sister, he has a sister who actually lives in Washington, D.C., but she is 2 years older and is already signed on to be the trustee of that trust. And beyond that, all we can do is try to have services in place for him. He's got a psychiatrist, a case manager, two of them actually, one for his regular living and another one for it's called a caddy waiver, which just means so you can live more successfully in the community without having to be in a higher level, more expensive living situation. He has a therapist and psychiatrist. So all of those things are in place. We've made sure that they're all in the same company. So the finger pointing that always goes on within the mental health system, it's your job, it's their job, or I didn't know about that, they should have been doing that. So now it's all in the one place. So, you know, that minimizes the finger pointing. And then we just hope and pray that he will, you know, not refuse to accept care and then they'll all be gone or something. But we've set up, you know, as much as we can to try to make sure that there's some continuity in his life and that he can live successfully. You know, it's just a guess because he has the right to say, I'm not going to accept any care from any of those people. And then all he would have would be his sister with his trust fund, and she's out in D.C. So, you know, you don't know, but you do the best you can.
Mindy Greiling is a former Minnesota legislator. She also helped found the nation's first state mental health caucus, and she is the author of the new book from the University of Minnesota Press, Fix What You Can, Schizophrenia and a Lawmaker's Fight for Her Son. So, Mindy, with all of this experience, personal and legislative, if you will, what changes in the status quo would you like to see?
I would like to see more long-term living arrangements for people with things like schizophrenia, the most serious mental illnesses. And I don't mean state hospitals or, you know, institutional care. My grandmother was in the Rochester State Hospital in Minnesota for 23 years, and then she went to a nursing home when she was older. I'm definitely not advocating for that, going back to that. But I think that there are models where people with schizophrenia could be very independent but still have more help than what our son is getting or what most people get, and that would be some kind of supportive housing. It could be, you know, 20 units, all kind of, everybody has their own apartment, but in the staff down at the main desk, you know, there could be a nurse or a social worker or somebody who could help them if they were having problems, get to know people, and they would have places to go. Our son was in a model called, it's a type of fair weather lodge program. It's nationally, there are small living arrangements that people with mental illness have, and he was one of those for 10 years. I wish he was still there, but it was a really good program where there's nice houses, kind of like group homes for people with developmental disabilities, but yet not, because there's not the 24/7 staff, just the people who live there, 4 to 8 per house, live there, and then the staff checks in, you know, during the week for group meetings or individual sessions. But by and large, the people there do their own cooking, their own grocery shopping, clean the place, monitor each other taking meds, and they all work in these programs, half-time up to full-time. And, you know, they pay taxes, they pay rent for where they live, and best of all, they have friends. That's, to me, one of the saddest things about schizophrenia is the loneliness. You know, if you've lost your friends and your brain is impaired in terms of initiative, the idea that you're going to make new friends for those ones that fled, you know, they tried, and you can't be, you know, complaining too much about them, because it's very hard for them too. They get married, have jobs, buy houses, have kids, and you don't have anything in common anymore with someone who's hasn't done any of those things. But in the Fairweather Lodge programs, people have friends, and they, you know, could take trips together or just chew the fat at night. And I mean, it's one, the lodge gym was in, they often played tennis. And so I think those kinds of things, this temporary, you know, often a chemical dependency program is 28 days, and the community care is often 30 days or up to 3 months, 90-day programs, and you stay in the hospital a very short while. Everything is geared to moving you along to the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, often with new people. And so stability, routine, you know, the pride of actually working, and also the having of friends and a good place to live, that's what people with schizophrenia need. And I'm not a fan of the model of living with parents, just because parents are going to die, as you mentioned, you know, before the family member, generally speaking. And I'm not a fan of what our son is doing now with his lonely apartment. And then he is over here a lot, and we, you know, we love him, we welcome him. He's really low maintenance now that he's doing well and he's sober. But it better if adult children, whether they have schizophrenia or not, have their own lives, and then they can relate to parents as parents and not total 100% support givers.
Mindy Greiling is a former Minnesota legislator and the author of Fix What You Can, Schizophrenia and a Lawmaker's Fight for Her Son, coming out from the University of Minnesota Press. Mindy, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an enjoyable conversation, and I hope your friend's son does well too.
Coming up on Main Street, Tom Ezern with a Plainsfolk essay and Sue Balcom with Main Street Eats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A number of national news outlets have started watching North Dakota's COVID-19 numbers. The state has among the highest per capita rates of COVID infections. In his weekly briefing, Governor Doug Burgum says the numbers are high due to what he calls COVID math.
As we test students, as we test healthcare workers weekly, we test in long-term care weekly. We know that we're identifying more pre-symptomatic and more asymptomatic cases in North Dakota, but this early identification helps us slow the spread, even as it does drive up our cases per capita.
Burgum says we may be the darkest period the state has faced during the pandemic. He says each of us has a role to play so the state can turn things around.
So if you're able to distance yourself from others, you will stop and slow the spread. When you can't distance, if you can wear a mask, you can stop and slow the spread. And if all of us were able to do this, be more conscious of both distancing or when we can't, making sure that we're masking appropriately in a way that we're not spreading it, we could dramatically see even by the time Halloween got here.
Burgum says controlling the disease can be done by implementing very simple things without the need for government intervention, mandates, health officer orders, or taxpayer dollars. Burgum says by taking personal responsibility, we can be a role model for the nation. Bismarck police have arrested a Mandan man who they say struck a Bismarck officer and three vehicles Wednesday. Police and federal marshals were trying to find Mardell Mariner, wanted on several active felony warrants. They found his vehicle in a parking lot, and as officers approached the car, Mariner came out of a building and jumped into the car. He hit a U.S. Marshal's vehicle, a police squad car, and an unmarked police car. He also struck one of the officers in the leg, causing minor injuries. Mariner, along with 20-year-old Catherine Yellowbird, were taken into custody this afternoon. Yellowbird was also wanted on several active warrants. And North Dakota Democratic legislators and legislative candidates say the COVID-19 crisis has put a spotlight on the need for spending on behavioral health services. They say the pandemic highlights the need for access to behavioral health services statewide and especially in rural areas of North Dakota. Will Thompson is running for the legislature from District 22. He says during this pandemic, many people are finding it harder and harder to keep anxiety and depression under control.
I know people who have relapsed since the lockdowns have started. And I know others that are struggling to maintain their sobriety with so many people around them, openly using alcohol and other substances to cope with all the stress. These are our friends, our coworkers, our relatives, our bosses, our neighbors. This is our community that's struggling.
Valley City Democratic State Senator Larry Robinson says the state has already taken steps to improve access to behavioral health services, but he says there's more to be done.
This is not going to be an easy lift. We have a tight budget. We know that. But I think there's increasing awareness across the state that this is an issue that must be addressed.
A voucher program to provide patients in rural areas money to seek to travel to seek treatment has run out of money. Robinson says the legislature needs to make sure that doesn't happen again. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
It's fall and election season is in full swing. I'm Dave Thompson. Join me, my Prairie Public colleague Matt Olean, and NPR for a series of regional and national debates throughout the month of October. Our next contest is for North Dakota's lone representative in the U.S. House. Republican Kelly Armstrong faces off with Democrat Zach Racknerud and Libertarian Steven Peterson. That's tonight at 7 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Mountain. You can count on Prairie Public to tell North Dakota's election story.
Prairie Public Live Debate Coverage 2020 is sponsored in part by AARP North Dakota.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history and the writer and voice of the Plains Folk essays you hear on our show. He's also a performer who loves folk songs, singing them, and studying how they came to be. Today's essay is titled Orphan Boy of the Black Hills.
On a February morning in 1925, there convened in Lincoln, Nebraska, a meeting of a genteel society, the Nebraska Writers Guild. The featured speaker was none other than the distinguished folklorist and linguist, Louise Pound. Pound was a woman of many and varied attainments. She ranks as perhaps the greatest female athlete in the history of the Cornhusker State. She would serve as president of the American Folklore Society and as the first female president of the Modern Language Association. She held a Ph.D. from the University of Heidelberg. And yet, the newspaper just referred to her as Miss Pound. Miss Pound, Dr. Pound, was a song catcher, a collector of folk songs from the Nebraska prairies. I gather, however, she was not herself a singer, because for the meeting in 1925, she brought a pianist and singer, one Mrs. Van Kirk. Among the songs presented was Those Dreary Black Hills, described as the regretful complaint of someone who had forsaken his eastern home and come to the hills region. In other words, had participated in the Black Hills Gold Rush that commenced in 1876. Stay away, I say, stay away if you can, far from that city they call Cheyenne, where the blue waters roll and Comanche Bill will take off your scalp in those dreary black hills. The other song catcher, who captured the same song from the air in the early 1900s, was the Texan John Lomax, who put Dreary Black Hills into his book, Cowboy Songs and Other Frontier Ballads. It remains a fairly well-known song among fans of folk song today, but, oddly, no one has ever traced its origins any farther back than the collections of the song catchers. Until last week, I did, and located what I believe stands as the earliest known text of the ballad, entitled A Black Hills Lament, and published in the Summit County Beacon of Akron, Ohio, on the 6th of June, 1877. When I got to the Black Hills, no gold could I find. I thought of the free lunch I left far behind. Through hail, rain, and sleet, nearly froze to the gills. They call me the orphan boy of the Black Hills. This is, indeed, a lament, a song of woe, speaking for the thousands of disillusioned gold seekers who failed to make it rich and went home, lamenting. In recent months, while investigating the origins of numerous old standards of Great Plains folk song, I have been evolving a general theory of folk song origin and spread on the prairies. You know, putting things into patterns the way historians do. I realize now that the Black Hills Gold Rush was a disruption in the pattern I had been constructing. It was what I have come to call a super spreader event in folk song history. Because it seems countless Black Hills gold seekers went home singing this song, Dreary Black Hills, in their own versions, but still the same basic song. They seeded it across the country for future song catchers to harvest. In 1877 to 78, it turns up in newspapers in Chicago, Illinois, in Central City, Nebraska, and in Peru, Oskaloosa, and Fort Scott, Kansas. I cannot say I have established the lineage of this orphan boy of the Black Hills, but we are acquainted with him now. As for that odd reference to Comanche Bill in the hills and in the song, I'll get to that on another day.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas, Director of Radio at Prairie Public, with an announcement for listeners to our Minot transmitter. We will not be off the air today, and we don't plan to be off the air for long periods of time anymore. We're very happy that the tower work that's been going on and required these long outages is finally to a point where we no longer have to turn off the transmitter while they're working. So thank you for your patience, and I hope you don't have to exercise it in our direction like that again.
Thank you, Minot.
Thank you so much for hanging with us, Minot.
Thank you, Minot.
Thank you, Minot.
Thank you, Magic City.
Thank you, Minot, for hanging in there. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being members of Prairie Public. Thank you for your support.
We got magic to do just for you. We got miracle plays to play.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public.
I'm Doug Hamilton, and Ashley Thornburg and I are pleased to speak with Sue Belkim every week about Main Street East.
Sue joins us from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm, for Main Street Eats. Sue, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. We're living the good life out here.
Yeah.
Food, it's family.
And pizza, specifically.
And pizza.
Pizza. It's National
Who
Pizza
Month.
Who doesn't
like pizza?
I know.
Isn't that awesome? October. I'm not sure why they would pick October.
I don't know. It's not even like tomato harvest
I look
season,
at National Pizza Year, and it renews every year.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. I have a Woodfire pizza oven, and I have probably had 15 or 20 pizza parties over the course of the summer. I definitely have had 4 in a single week. So pizza month just seems like
it's just not necessary to have pizza month.
I thought
right?
about cutting out my non-pizza carbs, and I really was just eating the same amount of carbs.
But you've got a pizza oven, and
that's
almost as hot enough to make steel, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, it has to warm up to 700 degrees. It's definitely a process. But we light it up 3 hours ahead of time, and then I just, play with the cat or do my yoga or, whatever I need to be doing at home.
That's what makes pizza great.
And then, and I have a fantastic couple of recipes that are, one's a sourdough, one is not a sourdough, and over the course of 9 years that we've had this pizza oven, really gotten to kind of dial in the recipe. And the answer, frankly, is Peter Reinhart, this master bread baker who does the Pizza Quest blog. Just follow his recipe, okay?
I'm going there right now. Oh, wait, we got to finish this first.
Yeah,
we have
you
to
have
talk
your
a little
own
bit
crust.
About pizza.
Yes.
Well, yes, and I've been after my husband to build me a brick oven out back because that is what separates the men from the boys.
Zach built ours for our wedding, and I'm pretty sure that's why we're actually married.
Oh, God, I can relate to that.
Yeah,
so
right?
Is he up for hire, maybe? Maybe I can have him build one.
Can we trade you?
For me.
For
oh my gosh.
And squash and tomatoes. All right. We'll work
Perfect.
This out.
Yeah. I'd be in debt.
We'll just put your husband. I'll talk to
life.
My people. You guys can talk
to
your people.
I was in Thailand, in North Thailand, a few years ago, and there was a fellow there at this bungalow camp we were staying at who was making a pizza oven out of clay. And it was a fascinating process to watch him. It was like this round ball with a chimney on it, and it was meticulously crafted, and it worked great.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why when you go to a pizza place, you're like, this is the best. Now, I'm not talking about, those pizza
we're
places.
We're talking wood.
I'm talking about
pizza.
A real pizza place.
Yeah.
And so that's what the difference is that your oven at home cannot get hot enough.
Yeah.
To replicate that 700 degree heat, which you need to really make a good crispy crust and get that, your vegetables cooked twice as fast, and then everything has just so much more flavor in it.
Yeah, well, and that clay bottom too, versus just putting it on a pan.
Right, but you can get a pizza stone at a relatively inexpensive price at like Target or someplace like that, which helps a lot, I think. And I actually keep one in my oven always because it helps when you do multiple bakes it helps keep that oven temperature.
Oh, it is nice.
It doesn't
I cool can't
off.
Figure out how to not break a pizza stone, though. I have broken too
well,
many.
Well, Ashley, cold water in a pizza stone, I'm sure you know about that.
I do keep trying to do high hydration bread.
Don't be squirting that.
Well, let's talk about the most important part of the pizza to some people. The toppings are very important, but the crust. Everybody's got an argument about the kind of crust they like.
Right, I don't like that thick fat stuff.
I don't
like,
either.
Thin and crispy.
I like it to just crunch. Yeah.
Right, almost like a cracker.
Very much like
edges.
That. Yep.
And you can achieve that if you're a sourdough bread baker. The next time you bake bread, just filter off a couple ounces there, and then keep it in your fridge till you're done baking your bread. And then when it's time for supper, we drag that out. And I actually make two now. I make two little ones, one for myself and one for my husband, so that we get more outside crust. if you have one big pizza, you only have one perimeter. But if you make two little ones, you each get your own perimeter. And then my kids, when they were young, we used to have make your own pizza parties all the time for their friends. You just put the toppings on the table and you give them a crust and then have them fill it up and we bake it and they eat it. And those were like really good times. And you know what? You don't have to have a special crust. Those kids will just remember that as being, I made my own pizza with my mom and my friends kind of day. And it was a good thing.
It is good.
Well, of course, besides the crust, there's the pizza sauce. That's another thing people might argue about a little bit.
Well, and I made my own this year because I had a glut of heirloom tomatoes, and that is not going to last us till the end of the year. It is so stinking wonderful.
Honestly,
oh my gosh, and I didn't use a recipe.
I can't do the store-bought pizza sauce. It's just terrible.
Not the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't have to make it and can it. You can make it that day.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes you don't even need pizza sauce. So, like when you have fresh tomatoes, I would just layer those, cover them with spices, onions, pepperoni. Mm-hmm. And I got a couple little things that I do to make, like with onions. Like if you just slice up onions and put them on a pizza and cook it in your oven, they're probably not going to be as palatable as if you slice them, lay them in a bowl, sprinkle a little tiny bit of sugar on them. That breaks those cells open, the ones that carry all that pungent flavor in an onion. Mm. And then you put a little salt over them and let them marinate for a while before you put them on your pizza. And they're so much more tender.
Mm-hmm.
You hardly know they're on there, but the flavor is there.
I'm going to try that.
Which is important.
Do you roast,
it works.
Do you roast your tomatoes before you make a pizza sauce?
You can or can't, because you know, when you have cherry tomatoes, you don't want to go through all the work of peeling those. So you slice them in half and lay them face up on the cookie sheet, cover them with a little olive oil and spice, and roast them down till they're leathery. And then we just put that on the pizza. We don't even make pizza sauce. We just use the tomatoes on there.
Yeah. I've been taken to roasting my tomatoes and then just putting them in the blender and with the other ingredients, of course.
Yep. But, and you can make the pizza sauce. Yeah, you can make the pizza sauce taste any way you want. Just add oregano, paprika, whatever spices you like. Yeah, wine.
Then you get some for yourself, some
one
for me, some
for the
sauce.
For the pizza sauce. Yeah. We all know how that works. And then, you know, you can use it or store it for a little while in the refrigerator. I find that when you buy a jar of pizza sauce, it's too big for two people anyway, and I always end up throwing the other moldy half away. So this way I was able to can sizes just perfect for us. And I learned a couple things about how to arrange your pizzas. And one of the mistakes that I've been making all these years is to put that sauce down first and then put your ingredients on top of it. Whereas if you put your ingredients down, then you put your pizza sauce in. Then I bake it for a while till the crust is golden. Then I throw my mozzarella cheese on and bake that till it's all bubbly. And if you can get fresh mozzarella and fresh tomatoes, oh my gosh.
You can never go back once you get the good fresh mozzarella.
Oh, I better be careful then. I'd better be very careful.
So good.
Better just answer the door.
You can make your own mozzarella if you can get milk that's not been pasteurized.
Yeah.
It's a fairly easy cheese to make.
It is.
And it's so funny to think about how pizza doesn't look like. I mean, back when I was in high school, which won't tell you how long ago that was, but you might be able to guess. If I tell you that only pizza we had was pepperoni, and we'd never made it at home. But remember Chef Boyardee? That was pizza back then.
Vividly, yes. It was a little different.
It came in a box.
Yes, it came in a box, and it didn't taste anything like what I can get today.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. You know,
it's so easy to get great pizza.
Yeah.
Oh, it is. It's so awesome. We have Fireflower Pizza here in town that has a brick oven that they actually take to art fairs and farmers markets and bake pizzas. But back when my mom would make bread, she would, you know, take a little bit of that bread dough and make what she called Speckkuchen, which was probably a form of German pizza. Because you would roll out that bread dough into a cookie sheet, and then she'd chop up leftover ham, and she'd put cheddar cheese on top of that and bake it, and then we'd eat that. And I always thought that was pizza growing up.
Well, it's a reminder that, you know, pizza dough is to me a kind of a flatbread, and you can make a pizza-like thing on lavash, yeah, on cracker bread, or mm-hmm, on flatbread. It's not the same. I'm not suggesting that it's pizza, but it sort of celebrates that tradition, that quick and easy, what have I got in the refrigerator that's fresh?
Yeah, you know, everything pizzas.
Right.
Yeah. Everything
pizzas.
Oh, that's
pizzas. The best thing. Yeah. She was like,
All and the veggies in the fridge. Or we've even done, like, one of my favorites is brie, lingonberry jam, and pistachio.
I'd go there.
Good pizza.
I would give
and,
that
like,
a try.
Figs
but
and
that
balsamic
could be a
is really good.
Pizza,
ooh, for dessert
right?
pizza, I like sweet potato mash with homemade
ooh
marshmallow fluff.
I'm gonna wait on that one.
Oh, I like that one. I'm a sucker for that one. Yeah.
So you're going to do the Nutter Butter, too? Peanut butter and marshmallow?
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, sometimes I just put that in a taco
pizza?
Shell, too. Yeah.
Hello.
I
a
know.
S'mores pizza. You could do that,
mm-hmm,
right? Chocolate and marshmallows.
Everything
and
pizzas.
You know, it's basically just something to carry
it's,
things into
yeah
your mouth, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what.
And if
and
you just
Milk
get
Street,
that good crispy crunch in your pizza
you guys
crust.
Are familiar with Milk Street,
yes,
right?
Yes, we are.
We carry it
cooking
on our
thing.
Yeah,
I think
we
actually
play it
has a segment,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I get their magazine, naturally, and it comes by in the email and it comes in print form. But they actually this month had a pour in the pan pizza crust recipe.
Oh.
So if you're intimidated mm-hmm by baking, I mm-hmm would suggest going onto their site and seeing if you can't find that pizza
Dude,
dough recipe.
I do that when we go camping. I will bring a hunk of uncooked pizza dough, like if we're only doing one night or two nights or whatever, and then whatever toppings we have, and then cook that in a pan over the fire or the camp stove. It's actually
right,
a pretty
cast
decent
iron
little camp
cans
pizza.
Yeah.
You
while know, while you're waiting for the choke
crust
cherry wine to finish, you can be making your campfire pizza.
I know.
But this
I
recipe
like fancy camping
is like a no-need recipe. You know, like you mix the ingredients together,
mm-hmm,
and you let it rise and fall and rise, and then pour it into a cookie sheet that's been spritzed with oil, and then using wet hands, you just press that dough out as thin as you like it, and we've all determined we all like it thin. I never understood why they rolled up cheese in a pizza crust. It just seems like overdone.
Yeah.
I really like the pepperoni and the tomatoes and the mozzarella cheese, mm-hmm, and the onions and the peppers. Mm-hmm. What other weird ingredients? Oh, we shouldn't ask that of Ashley.
But yeah, anyway, I got a whole list.
Doesn't get any easier than
sauerkraut,
that to
mashed
make
potatoes,
like a
really pickled eggplant,
sauerkraut and mashed potatoes.
Pizzas, yeah.
Okay.
Have you ever tasted my homemade sauerkraut? I bet that'd be awesome.
I have.
Mm-hmm.
Throw some kielbasa on there, mm-hmm, and you've got got an Eastern European pizza. Yes.
Everything pizzas.
Eastern European pizza.
It's
love
National
that
Pizza Month. We have celebrated with Sue Belcom. Sue, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, thanks, guys. Have a pizza on me.
Dakota Date Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck and dedicated to producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind projects in North and South Dakota. And by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home. Creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Dakota Date Book for October 8th. On this date in 1930, Eleanor Winkel was born in Mannheim, Germany, and grew up during the chaotic times of World War II. Eleanor's pediatrician, who had taken care of her since she was a baby and a friend of the family, was taken away. He was Jewish and was sent to a death camp. As the war went on and Allied bombing of the major cities increased, Eleanor was sent to relative safety with her grandparents in Schwetzingen. When the war ended, she was able to go back home, but safety wasn't assured. One night, she and her mother were trapped in their basement, unable to leave because of the night curfew, and they were threatened by some very drunk Russian men, but were rescued by a mysterious American soldier who stayed and protected them until morning. Later, when the occupying forces moved into Germany to restore order, Eleanor worked as a nanny, taking care of the two young sons of an American major. While working for the major, she got to know and started dating Sergeant Ellis Snell of Ellendale, North Dakota. After a 3-year courtship, they received permission from U.S. officials to marry. Eleanor and Ellis were wed on April 26, 1952, at Kassel, Germany. Tragically, however, Ellis soon developed acute leukemia and passed away that July. Eleanor accompanied her husband's body back to North Dakota for burial in Ellendale. She had a 3-month visa and stayed with Ellis's parents, but at the insistence of Ellis's mother, she overstayed her visa. This landed Eleanor in hot water with the U.S. State Department, and she faced immediate deportation. A letter-writing campaign was started, and thanks to the intervention of Senators Milton Young and William Langer, she was allowed to stay. After a 2-year negotiation, a bill was signed by President Dwight Eisenhower to make her a citizen of the United States. Eleanor went to Ellendale State Teachers College and met Edgar Bollinger of Monango, North Dakota, and they married in 1955 and had 2 children, Dwight and Mary. Eleanor Bollinger continued her education and received her Bachelor of Science degree. She taught in North Dakota for 33 years and earned entry into Who's Who among American teachers. Eleanor lost her second husband, Edgar, in 1991, and she herself passed away in 2017. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Scott Nelson. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The president attended a New Jersey fundraiser just hours before announcing he'd tested positive for coronavirus.
He, like all of us, if we are exposed, should immediately quarantine ourselves for 14 days because we can become infectious and infect other people.
We look closely at that event where the president was likely contagious on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and that means after the broadcast, you can always find Main Street as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, Jack Russell Weinstein will join us to preview another provocative episode of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. His topic will focus on whether our conscience comes from biology or universal moral laws. News Director Dave Thompson will talk about the week's big stories, and Matt Olin will reflect on the pandemic-caused turmoil in the film industry. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.